Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome, dear listeners. I'm Jonathan Carlin.
And I'm Benjamin Carlin.
And we invite you to join us through the Gryffindor, your one-way ticket to the enchanting world of Harry Potter. So grab your wands and dust off your broomsticks and join us as we unlock the treasures behind Chamber of Secrets, Chapter 7, Mudbloods and Murmurs. Oh. Sorry to throw such nasty language into the title there. I really couldn't avoid it.
I know. There's really no two ways around it. I know what the murmurs are.
Yep.
I'm surprised that without being referred to as murmurs,
yeah,
that they're chapter title worthy.
I agree. They don't. It really just sort of happens like right there at the end, and they're not called murmurs. But perhaps the fact that it is like in the chapter title should like clue you in, like that's like extra important. Like notice that, please.
Yeah, yeah.
Not that it doesn't really stand on its own, but
right.
It feels like maybe the chapter title was chosen for its alliterative properties.
There's always that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I do always love a good alliteration. But I remember stepping into this chapter, and for reference, for anybody who hasn't just like read this particular chapter and doesn't have it like totally top of mind, the murmurs are going to be in reference to Harry's detention hour with Gilderoy Lockhart, where he will first hear Slytherin's monster letting out murmurs into the castle a little bit there. So that's what it's in reference to. As I entered the chapter, I was like, what are the murmurs?
What are the murmurs?
Like literally, even having read this story as many times as I have, like it's funny because so often when I'm listening to the story, it's like usually with my headphones on the weekends when I'm doing like work around the house. And so like I don't pay a tremendous amount of mind to the chapter titles themselves very often. Like it's just sort of like going from one thing to the next. So that's what's so unique about this particular like project that we're working on is like the fine-tooth comb is directing your attention to like so many details that otherwise like you just happily glaze over and just sort of like, you know, let the story continue to unfold before
right, exactly.
You. But then when you're looking at it like individual by individual, it's like, well, now we need to analyze it. Like,
doesn't
make sense.
Yeah, we gotta talk about that. Let's look at this. Let's look at that.
Yeah.
So one of the first things I looked at, as usual, was the chapter art for this one, which I have never really given a proper look before. And at first I was like, okay, yeah, what's happening here? And it's sort of like Ron looking at a cauldron. And I think like at a glance, I wouldn't have even like what it is Ron and the slugs that he's puking up in this chapter.
Yes.
But like at a glance, even knowing that happened in the chapter, it was not obvious to me that that's what it was, because the cauldron is so big and it is overflowing with slugs. I'm like, I have vastly been underestimating the amount of slugs Ron is producing. Like
yes.
This is a waist high cauldron, which is literally overflowing with slugs. Like, oh my gosh, Ron, that I have not felt sorry enough for you over the years.
I know the sheer dehydration that would tax a human's body to produce this many slugs to come out of you. I mean, volume wise, I think that the cauldron is as big as one Ron Weasley as pictured.
I mean, yeah, he produces like his weight in slugs, if not more. Like, where is this happening from? And then, to make matters worse, he has to stay up past the midnight in the trophy room, like after being this sick all day.
Yes,
like,
yes.
This is like one of Ron's just worst days. Oh my goodness! I think it's a hilarious artwork, but it's. It just paints such a different picture. Like, I feel like in the movie, he's got like a bucket and he's sort of like belching them up, you know, one at a time here and there. This makes it look like there was just a never ending stream for a good, like, this is the only ones he caught in the bucket, you know?
Can you only imagine if he had actually successfully hit Malfoy with the spell? There is no doubt that Lucius would have been on premises.
There is. I mean, yeah, for this amount of slugs, he produced like one Draco Malfoy's worth of slugs here. That's way too many. It's like, not for nothing, though. I think it speaks to just how powerful Ron is. Like, I mean, this is, according to Hagrid later in the chapter, this is a tricky curse at its best. And Ron hits like a 12 out of 10 in terms of execution.
Yes.
If only he had sent it in the correct direction.
I know, yeah. Although, to be fair, this is maybe like one of those weird things where it's like a malfunctioning wand can barely produce magic, but maybe when it does, it produces like a tremendous amount of magic.
Perhaps, yeah.
Because when Lockhart will later be on the receiving end of a backfiring spell from Ron's wand,
yeah,
he will also have a memory charm that is like... like at 12 out of 10.
That's true.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, that like hospitalizes him for life.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Yeah. So I guess that there is at least a fair bit of continuity to the incredible degree of the power of the backfiring charm. That being said, I'm very curious to hear your thoughts. I'm looking at my first two pages, and this might be the first time for any chapters that we've had so far where I don't have anything highlighted or underlined on my first two pages at all.
I've got a couple of things going here. We already sort of talked about the wand. The thing that happens on the second page is that Harry is excited to just sleep in on the weekend, but nothing doing. Oliver Wood, captain of the Gryffindor Quidditch team, is ready. He is up at like 6 in the morning, just in Harry's dorm room, just like, wake up, Quidditch practice, let's go. Which to me is just like, there's like, it is surprising to me that Wood doesn't tell the team the night before, like, hey, we're having Quidditch practice right now.
Yeah.
It's like he's like, on the one hand, it's like annoying. But on the other hand, I absolutely love Wood's mania about Quidditch and the way he thinks about it. And it's like, I can only imagine that from his point of view, is like, if I tell my team that we're going to have to wake up on Saturday, there's a good chance that the other teams will learn that the Gryffindor team is practicing this early in the season and they'll start practicing early. So I just have to hit them with the element of surprise on Saturday morning. That way, literally no one will know.
I know. Well, it's really funny here because Wood reminds me so much of our own cross-country coach going back to high school. And the hilarious thing was we would have cross-country camp once per summer. This is a brief story, but one of the big things is that like coach wanted us to be out there before everybody, because like a whole bunch of teams from like the whole East Coast would be at the same, you know, Appalachian State University doing cross country camp.
Yeah.
And so like, you know, we would be the team that was like out in the lobby first thing in the morning. And his whole thing was that like, you know, he was going to go around to all the rooms and bang on the doors until every single one of us was up for the morning run.
Yep.
And so the way that we combated it was, because he would get super mad if you didn't come out. Like, I mean, you'd be like the center of his rage. And so what we would do is like, he'd come around at 6 a.m. to do this. So we'd be like running by 6:15. And so we would get up at like 5:45 and be in the lobby already. But then it was before he was awake. So he would go and beat down all the doors and be like, they all agreed to not get out of bed and skip the morning run. So he comes down just absolutely fuming. And we're midway through stretches and we're like, coach, where you been, man?
I did not know that. I missed that one.
Did you miss that one?
That must have been after I had graduated. That's hilarious.
It was so good. So anyway, as I was reading this, it was reminding me of our own cross country coach, who definitely had a similar level of tenacity.
Just like, we are going to be running. We're getting ahead of the game here.
Yes.
I did notice something is that like Wood is obviously has not told any of the team that this is going to be the case, and yet all of the girls have managed to make it down as well. And I am wondering, how did Wood awaken the girls? Because As you know, if the boys try and go up the staircase to the girls' dormitories, like a loud alarm blares.
Yes.
Which, as I'm saying it, maybe that's just what he did.
Yeah, right.
Wake up, ladies.
Well, he was apparently being loud enough. I mean, the other thing that's supposed to happen is the stairs are supposed to like fold into like a slide,
yes,
so that you're unable to walk up. So, don't know if maybe like Wood just came prepared for that or had his broomstick and just flew or something. I don't know.
What a workaround.
I know. Yeah, but it seems like Wood was not taking any chances on his team not waking up, because one Colin Creevy was able to be roused by this morning call as well, and is just like, okay, I'm going to be involved as well, and I'm totally coming to Quidditch practice.
That's totally it. I'm coming out there. I guess it's possible Wood like confided in some sort of other non-Quidditch player female to be like, all right, wake up. I'm going to need you to wake up early to go surprise the other girls, but do not tell them.
Do not tell them. Yeah.
Probably. Until the moment.
Right. The other thing I sort of got from Wood in this was a very like almost Percy energy, but like about Quidditch, which I don't know if this is like one of those things where it's like somehow it makes it more like admirable or agreeable or like less grating than like Percy's like absolute, like, because his like total commitment is to like rule following.
Yeah.
And like being like studious or something, which obviously there's nothing wrong with being studious, but it's like when Percy does it, it seems to come across a different way. But like, even if like Wood does seem to be like in like an overbearing level of like intensity,
yeah,
about doing this, to the point where I'm like, you could potentially be squandering like the effort that your team is putting forth because they're not like in it on the same level as you.
Yeah. I mean, I think he's just trying to hope that it, you know, lead by example. Like, it just rubs off on him. Like, if I'm this commit, how can I expect my team to be this committed if I'm not this committed?
Yes.
That's certainly at least the approach he's going for. And they do all get up and go down. But it's like there's a line later on in the books where Harry is like, has to hold tryouts for a chaser or whatever, and Angelina comes up and she's like, I'll be at tryouts, and he's like, you don't have to try out, you know,
like, you've already been on the team.
Yeah, you've been on the team. And she's like, don't hold that attitude, people have lost games because they haven't tried it, they keep playing the old players. And it's like, Wood is clearly like, nope, not doing tryouts, got my team, that's it, done.
That's true. So maybe like Wood is even like, it's like he's so determined to make what's there work that he's not even contemplating like stepping outside of anything else.
Well, he has some other glaring weaknesses as a captain that I think are going to pop up in a couple of paragraphs here as well, but
sure,
we'll get to that when we get to it.
Okay, yeah, sounds good.
Before that, yes, Colin joins the fray, mostly as an exposition dump to remind the reader the rules of Quidditch.
Oh my gosh, I wrote, because, yeah, you have the whole sequence here where obviously Colin is muggle-born, so he doesn't know any of the details, and Harry's just like, there's, you know, there's bludgers, there's two beaters, that's Fred and George, the quaffle, big reddish one, three hoops, and the fourth ball, golden snitch, that's me, seeker gets snitched, game's over, blah, blah, blah. And I literally wrote, like, hey, let's remind the readers of the rules the game.
That's exactly. Yep. But like, impressively done in like half a page.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Everyone's always like, Quidditch is so complicated. And it's like, well, Harry just did it in like four sentences. So it's not that bad.
It's really not that bad. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a bunch of like rules and stuff maybe you'd like to be aware of as well. But like, if you're just going to watch, that's like, I couldn't explain football in that many sentences, you know?
Oh, I know. Yeah. No, not, yeah. Not, can't even begin to do it. But
yeah,
this is another one of those instances though, like where it's like Harry is doing nothing here. Like this is like one of those instances like where it's like he's going to be like ridiculed by like Malfoy for there being like somebody there like taking photos of them, you know,
yeah,
or whatever, like at the Quidditch pitch. And it's like, Harry woke up this morning abruptly, didn't know he was going to have practice, and had no intention of anybody following him. And
yeah,
sure enough, it's just like Colin is just so like the absolute worst case scenario for the year Harry is attempting to have.
Yes.
Because he's just like, he's just like, he's so latched on. He's so interested.
Yeah.
And there's no escaping it.
There's really no escaping it without like just being like what feels like openly rude. But like one, okay, so I did highlight this. One of the things Colin does is he shows Harry the photo he took of him of Lockhart and Harry in,
yes,
the last chapter.
Yep.
And Harry, it says, he was pleased to see that his photographic self was putting up a good fight and refusing to be dragged into view, which I always think is hilarious. But it is interesting to me that Harry has like because this is the first time you've seen Harry in a picture, and it's like Harry has no say or no control over, like, he's just sort of like watching him in the photograph and he's like, ha, good for me down there, I'm doing what I would do. But it's like, he doesn't seem to have any like agency over what that picture of him does, even if it's behaving in the way he wants. But like, when Dumbledore like when Harry gets the chocolate frog card.
Yes.
And he's reading, he's like, I've got Dumbledore. And he like flips it over, he reads it to Ron, then he flips it back and he goes, he's gone. And Ron's like, well, you can't expect him to hang around all day. And it's like, well, why not? That when Ron says that, it makes it sound like Dumbledore has agency over the picture of himself in the chocolate frog card. Whereas in this case, Harry clearly has no agency over the picture of himself that Colin took.
I know. Yeah. This is interesting because I wrote something down about this as well, because I was like, it's fascinating to me that the photo was capable of capturing the subject's like true emotions inside of the scene. And so that's like literally like what I wrote down. I was like, is there a chance that like photos in the wizarding world are like extremely good evidence, like in the court of law, because like they would actually be demonstrating each of the individuals' like true intentions inside of like any given photo.
Sure.
So like if somebody was like captured taking a photo with somebody that they didn't want to be seen with, like in the wizarding world, the photo would demonstrate the person who didn't want to be in the photo was actively attempting to not be in the photo.
That'd be so bad to get your photos developed. Like Colin's like taking a picture with Harry and he's just like, hey, and then like he gets the picture and Harry's like, no.
Yeah. Or like Colin, wow. Like even if you're looking at yourself, like, so if Colin's looking at a photo of himself, like clinging onto Harry's arm who is attempting to like exit the frame or whatever, it's like, oh man, this went a lot differently than I thought it did.
Right. Yeah. Like, oh, that'd be bad feedback. But we actually, so I also bring this up because, like comparing it to the chocolate frog cards specifically, because you and I have a theory about how the chocolate frog cards work in regard to the Order of the Phoenix.
Yes, which is totally that, do. Yep. Yes,
which is that, perhaps even Dumbledore specifically, but like after, you know, Dumbledore is being taken down by the Ministry, like they strip him of his Order of Merlin first class and all of his titles or whatever, all that nonsense. Like they say like, oh, he doesn't care as long as they keep him on the chocolate frog cards. And it's like, it's just sort of like a joke. Like Dumbledore, like clearly just doesn't care about titles and stuff. Like, yes, thank you for them, but whatever.
Right.
Like, but like the chocolate frog card is like, oh, of course that's more important to Dumbledore, like being on some sort of like, you know, confectionery.
Right, right. It, I mean, especially but, for like Dumbledore, who's like passwords to all of, you know, the like, to the headmaster suite is always like a piece of candy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But like, so our theory, there's another line too, where it was like the Order of the Phoenix has more, you know, refined ways of communicating than, how, you know, Dolores Umbridge's fireplace or whatever.
Yes,
Snape says that.
Yeah.
But it's like, it's not explained what those methods are. So the theory is that that Dumbledore uses the chocolate frog cards and like has the order members carry around chocolate frog cards of himself as a way of communicating with them.
Yes.
Similar to like the Protean charm, like on the coins, which would explain then why Dumbledore might have like, more control over his appearance inside of the chocolate frog cards versus like Harry in this picture. And, would explain why he wants to say on the chocolate frog cards. And then in Fantastic Beasts, Crimes of Grindelwald, there is a extremely similar situation when Nicholas Flamel opens up that book and then he like flips over to the page with the professor from Ilvermorny.
Yeah, it's like a phoenix emblazoned book that like is almost like
the forerunners of the Order of the Phoenix.
Exactly. Yeah. But they have like a Zoom like relationship via this book.
Yes. So like to me, it feels like that is another example of like the same kind of magic Dumbledore is eventually using with the chocolate frog cards. So,
yeah, totally. Totally.
Anyway, this particular sentence just helped confirm that theory in my head that that's how Dumbledore communicates with the Order, is with the chocolate frog cards. And it's the sort of thing that Voldemort would never even think to look at because he's incapable of understanding fun things like candy.
Exactly. But the other thing I love about that as well is just simply the fact that like Hermione, with no knowledge that this was happening otherwise, also comes up with the coins, like which, I mean, I know you mentioned already, but it's just interesting to me that like literally like the Dumbledore's army is sort of like the junior version
of the
JV squad of the Order. And so it's like they came to the same conclusions. They realized the same kinds of needs, and in particular for Hermione, who would be like, communication is probably one of the most important and vital things that we need as an organization. It just like reflects like Dumbledore's own wisdom in someone like Hermione, who like all that is super cool. So anyway, yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I think that's it's such a fun theory.
Fun. It's like the trading cards. Yes. What good times. Oh, man. So anyway, we get down to the Quidditch pitch where reading this, is just like, it frustrated me reading this, especially knowing that eventually the Slytherin team shows up. Oliver goes out of his way to get his team down there. And then he's got three different boards, the first of which says, took nearly 20 minutes to explain about his team, like the kind of strategies they're going to do. And then he has two more under that. And it's like, are you telling me that like presuming they all took about 20 minutes, it's like he got them down there at like 6 a.m. and then talked to them for an hour.
Yes.
It's like, are you kidding, man?
Yeah.
Like, dude, like read the room. Like it should not be hard to tell that like several of them are asleep. Like get in the air first or something. I don't know.
Yeah. Get them back in the air. Get them back excited. Just sort of like dip their toe back in, because that's the thing too, is that like, you know, Harry, there's like the whole like sentiment of like Hogwarts is my home. It's like that is where Harry is like at his happiest. And he's just had like a rough first week of school, and even Quidditch, which like is arguably like his favorite thing to do, like his favorite recreational activity.
Yeah.
Also doesn't sound very fun right about now.
Oh my gosh.
And so
I know.
Like, man, like I don't like a world where Quidditch isn't fun for Harry, because that's like at the end of the day, what everybody's fighting for, like at the, like for all reasons all the time, is like so that people can go and enjoy themselves the way that they see fit.
Right.
And it's like, oh my gosh, Quidditch needs to be fun.
Oh, I know.
Like, you know, and it doesn't seem very fun. Right.
I know.
Now.
And then like, especially right here, which I just like, I was like, Wood, catch him a break, man. He says, now listen here, you lot, we should have won that Quidditch Cup last year. We're easily the best team, but unfortunately, owing to circumstances beyond our control, they don't win the Quidditch Cup in Harry's first year. And what he means is, owing to circumstances beyond our control, is that Harry was passed out in the hospital wing because he defeated Voldemort and stopped him from stealing the Philosopher's Stone and coming back and conquering the wizarding world. But,
well, yeah,
you know, and then like, and then the next sentence is Harry shifted guiltily in his seat. Like, guilty? What do you have to feel guilty for, sir?
It's exactly like last chapter where Lockhart's totally downplaying or attempting to match his own accomplishments to that of Harry's. And it's sort of like, why is everybody underselling the utter importance of Harry taking down the darkest wizard who has ever lived twice?
I know, especially because according to Dumbledore, like whatever happened down there was a complete secret. So naturally, everyone knows. And it's
yeah.
Like, if everyone knows, then why is everyone like freaking out at Harry? And then like, also just, I love how Wood's the reality of the situation and Wood's like interpretation of it just do not match at all, because he says like, we're easily the best team, but then also apparently without Harry, Gryffindor had been a player short and had suffered their worst defeat in 300 years. I'm like, dude, you know what? The best team, even a player short, wouldn't suffer the worst defeat in 300 years.
I know. Yeah. That, and I wrote the exact same thing. I literally wrote a note. I highlighted it and said, this seems absurd. And because when it comes down to it, it's like, even if they had not played any Seeker at all, it's like, surely in the past 300 years, Gryffindor has just lost a game ever, which would just mean like, in the Seeker only scores via the Snitch.
Yeah.
So it's like, you would just assume that the outcome of this game should be very similar to that of any other game where Gryffindor just didn't secure the Snitch.
I know.
First.
So like the rest of the points are just still on the other team.
Yeah, exactly.
Are on the rest of the team. It's not like Harry's doing anything to help them score points with the Quaffle.
I know. Yeah, this is the question though. It's like when you imagine Quidditch or like what it would actually be like in real life, the real question is almost like, is the Seeker contributing? It is never described this way. Like, it seems like for the most part, everybody goes up in the air. The Chasers are doing Quaffle stuff. The Beaters are doing Bludger stuff. You know, and Harry is looking for the Snitch.
Yeah.
And it's like, is it the case that like throughout the game, like there are like detours where like Harry is going and like flying in formation with the Chasers and they're like, oh crap, they got three people over there. No, wait, Angelina Johnson's actually over there this whole time. No way, we didn't see that.
I think there is one example, I think, where like Harry like shoots forward towards a group of like oncoming Chasers and like scatters them and like clears the way for the Gryffindor Chaser to score.
Right.
There
right.
is like one example of that, but like it is definitely not happening so much that they should have suffered their worst defeat in 300 years. And it also says they'd been a player short. And I'm like, are you kidding? Because layer, like you couldn't get like anyone to play.
Right.
Because like, you know, in years to come, like Harry will be a player short, and he'll just fill that role. He'll be like, Dean, you're in, or Cormac, you're in, right. Or I think, you know, Harry and Fred and George are off the team at one point, and it's like they still field a full team with substitutes. And speaking of Cormac, last year he would have been a second year. So like, where was he? Like, there is a known available player that could have filled in.
Yes,
like in, you know, even if Wood has to go play chaser or seeker, you know, like there's no reason you should have played man down. Like, I'm sorry, Wood. There's just that you did this to yourself.
The other thing too, and I'm trying to think of the games that we know they played last year. Obviously, Slytherin, I think, is the first game of the season. Is there a game against Hufflepuff next? Is that the other one?
Yeah, so that's the one he wins in like 5 minutes. So that's when Snape's refereeing.
Okay, so then the last game of the season would be against Ravenclaw.
Yes.
So like even that one, it would be like such poor sportsmanship on behalf of Ravenclaw to go and know that the opposing team. Team's seeker couldn't play this particular game because of like very real life important matters, and then just go completely run up
just
the score.
Dunk on. Yeah, that's basically what had to have happened because Gryffindor is going into it 2-0.
It seems unlikely, you know? The whole way around. I think the real thing, the real issue they have here is that clearly, I think what we will eventually learn about how the Quidditch Cup works, at least at Hogwarts, is that points play a role. So I think at some point, like when Cedric beats Harry in Prisoner, like they're still not out as long as they can beat Ravenclaw by like a certain
margin. Yeah,
exactly. So I think what must have happened in year one is that like you don't want to give Gryffindor both the Quidditch Cup and the House Cup, and so it's like you want to like make the reader work for that as time goes on. Like this is something like a carrot on a stick that we can still lob out into the future. We can still desire it. We can still covet it. We'll like work our way towards achieving this particular accomplishment on behalf of Harry, but not this year. And so the big thing is almost like, okay, so they basically came in and beat Slytherin right away, and then they pretty much came and stomped Hufflepuff.
Right.
So it's like they pretty much, in order to have like need, like they would have had two wins out of three games that they would play. In order to not win, they would have to lose atrociously.
Yeah.
That's basically the only explanation.
That's basically it. So like, I wonder who did win then, because we know at least Hufflepuff and Slytherin suffer losses, and it's like Ravenclaw wins against Gryffindor. So like, did like Ravenclaw win the Quidditch Cup last year?
That's a good question. I mean, feels likely.
Does feel likely.
I mean, if they would have put up so many points on, unless Ravenclaw lost to both Slytherin and Hufflepuff and only beat Gryffindor, which would also seem, I don't know. Yeah.
It does seem like if it was the worst defeat in 300 years, it feels like they were like, you know what? If we just put up points, we can steal this thing.
I know. Yeah. Maybe that's exactly it. And so maybe Ravenclaw came in, you know, otherwise undefeated, and we're just like, okay, we got to do it. That's the reason. Okay, we worked our way into a reasonable explanation for it. But either way, I still think it seems absurd.
Yes, Harry feels guilty at all, or that Wood is like shaming him for not playing, is absurd.
Yeah. We even get the line, the last defeat was clearly still torturing him. Yeah. I mean, to be fair, Wood, keeper, you probably let through something like 350.
True. Yeah. That's true.
Yeah, Wood should be beating himself up a little bit.
That's true. Because like, to be their worst defeat, it like, if someone just caught the snitch, it like within 1 minute, you know, like right away, it's like that will always happen. You can almost erase 150 points off every score.
Yes,
you know, that's always there. So for it to be the worst defeat ever, it's like he had to be the one letting the goals in, because certainly unless he was playing seeker instead of keeper or something. But
oh, that seems possible.
I guess so.
That would be terrible logic.
Yeah.
You know, like if they just like don't field a keeper and like run a seeker instead, it's like,
because
you can win even, I mean, that's like the whole,
like Ireland win, but Crumb catches the snitch.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like you are capable of winning the game, you know?
Yeah.
Like otherwise. Like,
so. Yeah. Just if you're apparently the best team out there and you're scoring at will otherwise, just score as fast as you can and don't let their seeker have a chance. That should have been the strategy. Also, field a seventh player.
Do that. Yeah.
Just anyone.
Anyone. Yeah. Anyone who put Neville out there.
Right. Maybe they just put him in front of the ball. Maybe they'll just hit him.
You know? Exactly. Like, just park him in front of one goalpost, and that's it.
That's it. Yeah, they can't score
they
here.
They can't score here. Yep. Anyway, so otherwise, yeah. So we're getting a feel for just how long-winded, I guess, rather Oliver Woods training.
Yeah. The sun is completely up.
Yes, the sun is completely up. Then it's you get sort of like a really. Just good timing, I guess, in terms of like what plays out. But Colin is now just frantically clicking away, taking photos of...
Oh, that's the other thing. Colin is still out there. Yes. They've been in the locker room for like minimum an hour at this point. He's just been like, I guess this is how it goes.
I'm not even hungry
I got
anyway.
Nothing to do.
Yeah. So no problem whatsoever. But I mean, this is like one of those things where like Oliver is like, he could be a Slytherin spy trying to find out about our new training program. Paranoid much?
Oh, I know. It's so paranoid, but I was like, I also just sort of love his tunnel vision. Like, everything is about Quidditch.
Yes.
Why is that person taking pictures? It's probably a Slytherin spy. It's like, dude, that shouldn't be your first guess.
Right. But the timing, though, and Slytherins don't need a spy, Oliver, said George. What makes you say that? Said Wood testily. Because they're here in person, said George, pointing. Several green robes are walking onto the field, broomsticks in their hands. Oh man, this is another one of those things where it's just like the circumstances don't make sense to me based on just like how professional teachers should or could operate. But basically what we have going on here is the Slytherins, owing to the need to train their new seeker.
Oh, Snape is being such a Snape right now.
He absolutely is. It's like, okay, it's the first week of school. Every Quidditch team is probably needing to train
exactly what I wrote. I said, this would have been true of any team. This is such dumb reasoning.
I know, like, yes.
Yes. Owing to the need to train their new seeker. Like, what if the Gryffindors had a new seeker? It'd be like, oh no, we can't impede on that. But because it's the same seven, it's okay to double book it.
This is the type of thing where it's like, in my mind, there could be a scene and like, this is like, whenever I imagine a much more drawn out version, like TV show version of this, where we can get like a lot more perspectives of more characters, like even if it's happening in the background of a scene, having something after this sequence where McGonagall is just absolutely ripping Snape a new one, like in the Great Hall, because Snape is overriding one of his colleagues in order to do this.
Oh, basically,
someone is
like,
mad.
There is clearly like a go sign up. If you're a Quidditch captain, here's the sign up sheet for the field, and clearly, like Flint was like, well, they booked it. I need to take this to Snape right now.
Yes, exactly. Because that's the other thing too, is that like Wood must have put it somewhere public enough that Flint could know. So going back to your idea that like Wood was trying to keep it a secret or whatever, because he didn't even tell his own team that practice was happening.
Yeah, Flint knows. Yeah, he knows enough to go get a note.
Right.
Your team doesn't know you have practice today, but the Slytherin team, now maybe he's correct to be worried about spies, I guess.
Yeah, there you go. Paranoia confirmed. Yeah,
I would love a subplot in the TV show where it's just like Wood versus Flint on the side and just complete like...
Oh, that would be incredible. Yeah, like if you just got this like other plot entirely that it's just like they're like in class antics and rivalry and like everything that they're doing, like pulling strings and such. Yeah. No, I love that. That seems like a blast.
That'd be super fun.
I wouldn't mind more Oliver.
Also, I also love though when so Draco steps out and Fred says, "Aren't you Lucius Malfoy, son?" Which I think is a fantastic greeting because Draco thinks of himself as like so popular and but I love how in this situation, his reputation does not precede him. You know? He's like, who are you? Never seen you before.
It's like, and now our grand reveal, Draco Malfoy. Yeah. And you're like, wait, who?
Who? Are you Lucius Malfoy's kid? Yeah, never seen you before. Sorry.
Yeah, never heard of you.
Never heard of you. So I like Fred's sort of, I don't know if it's better if Fred genuinely doesn't know who he is or if he's doing it on purpose, but
I think the way it reads is that he doesn't know who he is, but I like to think that he did it on purpose.
Yeah, exactly. There you go.
I'll take that as the interpretation. Then we of course learned that for some reason of the year 1993, they have gone from the Nimbus 2000 to the Nimbus 2001, where the entire Slytherin team has all of their fancy new broomsticks.
Yep. Sweeps the board with them. Again, I think it's just worth pointing out that when these books were coming out, it was like when the time period in question, the in canon year is what, 1992? No. Right? So.
Oh, yeah. I guess you're right. I guess it would be 92 right now, technically.
The in-universe year is 1992. So the fact that they came out with the Nimbus 2000 and went straight to 2001, which when the books were coming out in the real world was happening like at the turn of the century. So around 2000 and 2001.
Yes, exactly.
It is just silly that this is their naming convention for the brooms at this point in time.
Yes.
But whatever. Yep. Not important. No, not important.
Yep.
Let's see. Draco goes on to list off some sick burns. He said, you could raffle off those clean sweep fives. I expect a museum would bid for them. I was like, that's pretty funny.
Oh, really? Oh, my gosh. That is so funny because I literally think it says the Slytherin team howled with laughter. And I wrote, really not that funny. That's really hilarious that our interpretations were exactly opposite. Because it's like, I don't know that I've ever said anything in front of a group of people where it made the entire group of people howl with laughter.
Yeah.
So anyway.
I think maybe it's because like maybe it was the Shooting Stars or whatever broomstick we were reading about Ron, where he was like being outstripped by butterflies or something.
Yeah.
It's like they were genuinely super old brooms. I was like, oh, he's probably right.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But then Hermione totally zings one back with the.
She does.
At least no one on the Gryffindor team had to buy their way in.
Yeah.
They got in on pure talent.
Yeah. I also wrote sick bird next to that.
Yeah.
So.
I put boom.
Boom.
I love it because this is like, and I even like the fact that it says the smug look on Malfoy's face flickered. It's like yeah, Malfoy.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
You didn't. Like, yeah. He's like, that's exactly what happened. Butts. And then it's not like he goes on to like win many games either that I'm aware of.
That's true. That's true.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, we know he can fly, but
whatever. We know he can fly.
Through the Gryffindor is sponsored by Rosetta Stone. Y'all, I've got to say, I love international travel. I don't know if there's anything that opens your eyes and mind more to different walks of life than immersing yourself inside of new ones. But one hesitation I always have about going somewhere new is how to best navigate the differing languages. But that's where Rosetta Stone can help. Because for me, it's not just about like the fear of getting lost, although to be fair, it's not a concern either. But to me, the immersion goes so much further than simply being somewhere else. I want to engage with and respect the locale by communicating in their tongue, not my own. And that's what's so great about Rosetta Stone. They provide 25 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, German, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Dutch, and more. And they use such an intuitive approach designed for you to pick up the language naturally, so you're really learning to speak, listen, and the one I always find the most fascinating, think in a new language. And what's even better is that when you sign up, it's for life. Yeah, a lifetime membership. Because let's face it, we can only travel to so many new places, but so fast. But with all the time in the world, you can be ready for any adventures ahead. Don't put off learning that new language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, Through the Gryffindor listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off your unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
Catch those springtime vibes all over Arizona. Break out of the winter blues by hitting the water at one of our lake and river parks. Take a hike among the wildflowers. Just make sure to stay on the trails and leave the flowers for the bees. Discover Arizona's best kept secret and visit azstateparks.com/amazing to start your springtime adventure.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only, not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Yeah. Then of course, though, it kind of takes a turn for the worst, as sometimes things do in high school, where Malfoy just takes it way too far and calls Hermione a filthy little mudblood, which is like one of those things where it's like, I feel like I will say it the one time necessary to describe what he says, but even saying it out loud, I'm like, I just don't like just saying it.
Rude.
You know,
it's
such a mean thing to say.
I know.
So we needed the context, but that's the end of that. So anyway, yeah. So just a horrifically mean thing. And it's just, I mean, even if you don't know the context, which I think sort of is what's happening a little bit, like with Harry and Hermione themselves, it's like you can tell like what he just said wasn't a good thing.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You can tell. And obviously the team reacts in such like a visceral way.
Yes.
Like it's like, all right, that's it. Time to bust out some wands.
Yep. Yeah.
And you know, Ron of course busts his out, and we sort of talked about this earlier. Apparently he hits him with just the world's greatest slug belching curse known to man, except it hits himself. But Ron also in this moment does not utter an incantation, right? So not only does he perform what Hagrid will describe as a very tricky curse, but he does it very powerfully and non-verbally.
And non-verbally, I know,
like,
yeah.
Like, don't skate over Ron here.
Well, and that was another one of, like, as I was reading the chapter, I was like, he's not going to say eat slugs again, is he?
Yeah,
like,
right?
It's like, I'm pretty sure just like, last
you
chapter.
You just said that, yeah. Man.
It's like, you got to pick something else.
Yeah.
You know, but you're right. And it's also interesting that it's a jet of green light that shoots out the wrong end of Ron's wand.
Yeah.
Which I was kind of like, man, jet of green light. Like, we know what a jet of green light typically is.
I know, right? It's normally, it's the same color as Avada Kedavra.
It is indeed, so yes.
There's that. And then I think this chapter I just thought was very funny. So Ron starts belching up the slubs. Colin shows up to just, you know, make matters worse. He's like beating away. He says, ooh, fascinating, raising his camera. Can you hold him still, Harry? I literally wrote, like, Colin, read the room, man.
I wrote, read the pitch, Colin. That is funny.
I know. It's like, can you hold him still? It's like, oh yeah, I'm just vomiting up slugs over here. Don't worry. Yeah, take a picture.
It's like, gosh. It's like, Colin, those are our rivals, man. I know. Stop
it.
Oh man.
I know. That was really funny. Anyway, there we go. So they bring Rod to Hagrid's hut, where, of course, Gilderoy Lockhart has just inserted himself into the situation, wearing robes of palest mauve today.
Mauve?
Which is a pale purple.
Oh, is it? Okay. Okay. Yeah. So he's deviated ever so slightly
from his green looks. Yeah. Or his blue looks.
Yeah. can we remember our last batches of colors?
Oh, God. It was turquoise. Was that it last time?
Man.
No, it was forget-me-not blue and then turquoise and then some other aquamarine.
Is it aquamarine? I think aquamarine sounds right.
He has had aquamarine at some point as well.
And then forget-me-not blue, yeah. I think is at the...
what's he teaching class in?
I know, that's the question. Oh, goodness gracious. You'd think that we're putting so much energy into this particular endeavor.
I know, to remind me.
And we're still so bad at it.
I know.
I just want to overcome this problem, and yet I'm immediately seeing why it's such a challenge. So anyway, he's wearing palest mauve, and he comes strutting out. I'm curious how many like cases he needed to bring with him to school, because it sounds like
a lot.
Yes. Either which way though, we get another instance of like Hagrid clearly like just plainly saying like, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about.
Oh, I know. Yes.
Yes. And specifically about how to get kelpies out of a well, which I put three question marks next to him and said, really? Aren't like kelpies like huge? So I mean, isn't a kelpie what we see?
Oh, like the horse?
The horse, like a water horse type like creature?
I think you're right.
Like,
yes.
Like plimpies, you know, maybe.
Yeah, plimpies out of a well. Also like, do we even know of Hagrid having a well? Or like, I'm trying to imagine what prompted Lockhart to go down there. If he just like woke up and was like, ah, I think I'll have a chat with Hagrid about how to remove kelpies from a well.
Yes, yes. Yeah. I know, yes.
It's like, why?
Stop showing your hand, bro. You don't know what you're talking. And you know you don't know what you're talking about. Anyway, so that's like one of those things that we're like, I guess when visually you see what a kelpie looks like, though, in Fantastic Beasts: Secrets of Dumbledore, is that when we get the kelpie, or is it Crimes of Grindelwald? It's like, wow, okay, the kelpies plural are in as well.
I know. Are they? Is newts just huge, or
maybe so? Maybe they're freshly hatched kelpies.
Also, well, Hagrid's advice to Ron is, I don't think there's anything to do except wait for it to stop. I was like, how would you know? Have you been hit with this? Like, that is not the news I would like to hear if I was Ron. I'd be like, yeah, let's go to the hospital wing. There must be something you can do.
Surely.
Surely. Yeah, because it doesn't stop until like after midnight.
But Hagrid does say that it's a complicated spell. So yeah, I mean, maybe he's done it before.
Yeah, it's a difficult curse to work at the best of times.
Yeah.
But with a broken wand.
Oof.
Let's see. The other like little tiny little noteworthy thing here is that Hagrid growled Hagrid's moving a half plucked rooster off his scrub table and setting down the teapot. That is just like a tiny little nod that there are roosters at Hagrid's.
Yeah, I mean it's not only a tiny little nod that there are roosters at Hagrid's, but I think also it says like a page later that Ginny had just come by the day before.
Yes.
Talking about like possibly hoping to run into Harry.
Yeah.
And so at this point, I mean, we know because of the murmurs later on in this exact same chapter, we know that Ginny is starting to do things already.
Oh, yeah.
Just the first week of school with the Chamber of Secrets.
Like, so the diaries are, I mean, I guess we sort of already knew, I guess she's already been writing in it before they left because they had to turn around to go get it. And she was like, oh my gosh, diary.
Yes. So for full context, the cry of a rooster can kill a basilisk.
Yes.
Which would be the reason why they keep being killed. So it's possible the half-plucked rooster was done by Ginny, and in fact the reason that Ginny was hanging around Hagrid's hut had nothing to do with Harry at all.
Oh, for sure, it had nothing to do with Harry.
Yeah. And instead she was the one who possibly, like,
yeah, did she kill this rooster? And now Hagrid's like, well, I may as well eat it.
I think so.
Yeah, I think that is the takeaway here.
Yes. So anyway, then we learn a little bit more about Hermione is attempting to defend Lockhart, basically saying to Hagrid, like, I think you're being a bit unfair. Professor Dumbledore obviously thought he was the best man for the job. And so I wrote for a job, but maybe not the job of teaching. And as per always, we keep bringing up Dumbledore's big plan and showing Harry about the dangers of fame.
Then Hagrid begins to allude to the rumor that the Defense Against the Dark Arts position is jinxed, which Hagrid is like on the money with a lot of stuff in this chapter. It's like that is, well, he's obviously wrong about what Ginny's intentions are, but he can tell that Lockhart is full of it, and he is into the rumor that the Dark Arts job is jinxed, and like, yep, no one's been able to hold it for a while. And it's like, yes, a short, which is to me is always surprising that no one's like really figured it out yet, because it's been like 30 years or something. Or how long has it been?
I was trying to do the math. I don't know if we know the exact year, because let's see. So this is like one of those like math, but like Tom Riddle, I think, was born in 1926. And so he would have graduated Hogwarts in 43. And then he's like off working at Borgin and Burks for some amount of time because he's denied the job of teaching immediately after school. And then he returns to Hogwarts. I've always sort of thought like circa like 1950.
Okay.
Or like somewhere in that range. And so this would be
this is when he hides the diadem.
Yes. Yeah. So, be hiding the diadem. So this is approximately, and then Dumbledore denies him the job.
Right.
The second time. And then it's,
and it's been cursed since then.
Yeah. So I think 40 years is a safe bet at least.
40, so yeah, for more. 40 years, no one's been able to keep this job for more than a year.
Right.
It's almost surprising. This is another thing, like when you learn later on that, like, because you also know that Snape wants this job.
Right.
Which I guess maybe Dumbledore is hesitant to give to him because he thinks that means he'll be like something will happen to him year.
That probably is the ultimate interpretation.
Yeah.
And maybe it's even something that Snape himself is unaware of.
Yeah.
Like, why do you keep turning me down? Like, yeah, I want the job.
I know. Like, come on, dude. Especially because like his later solution is like to go get Slughorn. It's like there are other potions professors he could go get too.
So
Snape could have the job.
But, right.
Clearly, I think that just points again to like Dumbledore really wants Harry to see this particular kind of fame and not aspire to it. And that's why he's leaned on Lockhart instead.
Yep, there you go.
Also, it's ridiculous, though, that like by the time Order of the Phoenix rolls around, that he can't find someone to fill the job because he literally has the Order of the Phoenix at his disposal. And it's like, why? You can just make someone do it now.
Like, I know.
You don't even like, you don't even have to like ask for a hire.
Right. No, I know. Yeah. It's like, at this point in time, just have Tonks come teach. It would be super interesting and way more fun. Although it's like Umbridge is like one of those things where it's like you desperately want it to not have happened. But I think that that's like part of like a morbid appeal of Umbridge eventually, which I'm sure we'll talk about a lot when we get there. But it's like you, I mean, you have every reader seems to have like a visceral dislike of this particular character.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's accomplishing something.
Yeah. Is it like, I mean, is there any chance that Dumbledore like wants her there for the same reason, just to like make sure Harry will not trust the establishment?
I think there's something to that.
Yeah.
I mean, because she would be like everything that would be wrong with the establishment, where it's just blind faith in what's going on. I mean, it's actually kind of similarly to like what Hermione has with the Gilderoy Lockhart books right now.
Right.
Ironically, which is just basically that she's always trusted books, so she just assumes that they can't possibly be lying to her. And Umbridge basically has just always trusted the establishment, and therefore it must be correct. And
right.
Like, anybody who's standing in opposition must be wrong.
Exactly. Yeah. All right. So let's see. They tell Hagrid more about what it was. I love how like just how upset Ron continues to be, even though he's like puking the slug. He's like, it was bad. It was about the most insulting thing you could think of. Like, manages to explain it, which I love that Ron gives this explanation here, like, in the book, because, like, this is something that they switch who does this in the movie, where Hermione is the one giving away this information. And it's just, like, one of those things where they, like, they steal from Ron's importance in the movies, where it's like, this is the sort of thing he's good at. Like, he's lived in the wizarding world, so he knows, like, the you know, what these racial slurs mean in a way that, like, Hermione doesn't.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think you're right. Like, it's interesting in the movies, the frequency, like that there's like little things like that kind of get tossed around, and it's like, I mean, maybe contextually, like, I don't know, like it could work for some other reason that is harder to see, but like I agree with you where it's like the key thing that Ron is usually able to provide the group that both Hermione and Harry don't have is a lifelong history inside of the wizarding world, and therefore just kind of like this general wealth of knowledge that's hard to know any other way than having lived
it. Having lived it, yes.
Yeah. So, of course he knows it. Then I think we get some really great Hagrid moments. He says, Hagrid's, you know, sort of... like coming to Hermione's defense and says, and they haven't invented a spell our Hermione can't do. And he said Hagrid proudly, making Hermione go a brilliant shade of magenta. Love that. You know, that's just like one of those things where it's like Hagrid's just like totally doting on her. And I love as we scroll down a little bit. Well, then he gives some like good wisdom about like, it's probably a good thing you didn't actually hit him. I suspect Lucius Malfoy would have come marching up here and, you know, you would have been in a lot of trouble for that.
Mm-hmm.
But then he shifts his attention to Harry.
I know.
And I think this is the funniest thing. He says, got a bone to pick with you. I hear you've been giving out signed photos. How come I haven't got one?
Oh, man. I learned the same thing.
Yeah. I just said top shelf humor, Hagrid.
I know. Like, he just knows exactly how to poke him right here.
It's like this is like one of those things where like Hagrid is not always like the most like socially conscientious person we've ever met, but this is like one of those where he's understanding the layers of the situation well enough to know like Harry's gonna hate this.
I know. Yeah, it's like he's like it is funny. He's like actually trolling him right here.
He is a little bit,
and he totally gets him too.
Yes.
Oh my gosh! Only joking. You're more famous than him without trying. Or he says he said that to him. Bet he didn't like that. Don't think he did.
I mean, there's something as someone who is like a textbook people pleaser in life, this whole exchange here to me is something that like I aspire to, where it's just sort of like, yeah, said something he didn't really like it that much. It's like, oh well.
Like, good, too bad for him.
Too bad for him. I
sucks
know.
To suck.
Yep.
Oh man. So we continue on at Hagrid's here. You get a little bit of a little reminder. He had been expelled from Hogwarts in his third year, but Harry had never found out why. And it's like it's one of those things like you don't even realize that the mystery of the Chamber of Secrets was starting to be set up in year one back on like the House in the Hut.
Yeah.
Or whatever. Yeah, but it's like, yeah. Oh yeah. So it's like, but because it was brought up then and not resolved, it's sort of like you have no idea that it's like when it's going to be resolved. Like certainly eventually you'll learn, but it's like it's telling you, it's reminding you of it in this book, but you're not like because it was set up in the last book, you're not aware that it is going to be like a central cog in this book.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep. And Hagrid is otherwise so like, you know, positive and jovial. He it's definitely one of those things where you would never assume that he would have like a direct connection to what is eventually going to be going on at the castle.
Yeah. So let's see here. Then he does drop the line about Ginny. He said, that's what your little sister said. Met her just yesterday. Said she was just looking around the grounds. Which is like, even if you like, if you look into just that, the way he phrases this, it was like, she didn't go to visit Hagrid. Like, Hagrid does meet with her and talk with her, but it's like, it's not like Ginny specifically went to visit Hagrid. She's just like wandering around by herself, which you just sort of like, and then it's like there's such a good diversion here. It's like, I reckon she was hoping she might run into someone else. And it's like, but that's not, even that doesn't really make sense. You know, because what is this? This is like Friday afternoon that she's doing this.
Yes.
Like where, like the place Harry's most likely to be is like in the Gryffindor common room.
Where
like,
she also not, has access
where
to.
Where she has, it's like, yeah. It's not hard to run into Harry.
Exactly. Yeah. Know? Yeah. At this point in time, yeah, this is like one of those things where it's like, it always feels like there's this like kind of blurry illusion going on as if there's like way more students at the school. But like, you know, you have like maybe 70 students total in your house. Like that is not that many people. You would know 70 people by name in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And especially if like the person that you want to talk to happens to be your older brother's best friend.
Yeah.
You're absolutely crossing paths.
Yeah.
But either which way.
Especially because earlier in this chapter, it was revealed that apparently Colin Creevy's already memorized Harry's schedule. And it's like, Ginny's already obsessed with Harry. So probably she could have done that if she wanted.
Yeah. Probably you know? So could.
But like,
have, yeah.
So obviously she's out being, well, not obviously being suspicious, but like that is what she's doing.
But it's a good misdirect. This is another it one is of those a good things diversion. Where it's like, you would never think twice about it or have any reason to think twice about it because it's been so reinforced that Ginny has kind of got this like crush on Harry from afar. And so it's like, if you're reading this the first time, you could read this chapter of this page and there's nothing about it that would stand out in such a way that you're like, ooh, that seems suspicious, or even like the rooster. But then like once you know, you're like, oh, I know exactly what was actually happening.
Exactly. Yep. Sneaky.
Very sneaky.
Ba-ba-da-ba-da. All right. What's the last thing? Let's see. Then they go back upstairs and they have detention, right? That's what happens next?
Yep. Pretty much go back up to the school. McGonagall lets him know that there's going to be two sets of detentions that are going to be separate, that Ron is going to be polishing silver in the trophy room with Mr. Filch and with no magic, just elbow grease, which like totally, like it's like one of those things where like, yeah, like if I were to have to go and do it, I would just assume that I would do it with elbow grease.
Right,
so
yeah.
it's like funny that that's like an extra layer of punishment for Ron. But then, of course, Harry is going to be helping Professor Lockhart answer his fan mail.
Yeah. just like, oh, no, Professor, can I do the trophy room too? Certainly not. Oh, man. So then they go there. Harry eats something a little less bland for dinner. He has a shepherd's pie.
Hey, way to go, Harry. Way branching to go. Out.
I know. I love when he gets into Lockhart's room. He goes, here's the scalawag.
The scallywag. Of course.
Yeah. Oh my God. Lockhart, he's just so silly. Let's see. I love how he has he has countless framed photographs of himself in the room. I just wrote like, can you imagine?
I wrote the same thing. I was like, imagine having signed framed photos of yourself.
I know.
It's like, oh my gosh, man.
Dude. It's like, what are you doing?
The vanity. The next page, we see that Lockhart generously is allowing Harry the opportunity to address the envelopes.
I know. I know. He's really under the impression that this is like he saved Harry from a detention. It's
I know,
like,
yeah.
What a treat. Just come help me address envelopes. That'll do it. The first one is to Gladys Gudgeon, bless her. Huge fan of mine, which, fact, she is.
She is indeed. Yes. She continues to be a huge fan, even to when you fast forward. That's like one of those like fun like little like callbacks way after the fact in Order of the Phoenix when it's Christmas on the closed ward and you're getting to run into Lockhart again for the first time since Chamber. And I think it is also the case that Gladys Gudgeon in that chapter is still writing to Lockhart.
She reminds me of Madame Marsh, who's always on the night bus.
Ah, yes, like, indeed. Yes, yeah,
this person's associated with this thing. It just creates these like little continuities between the characters or the objects or whatever.
I know. I love it. I love
it. So that's pretty fun. And so I love also, I mean, how long does he say it takes? It's like, it says it's after midnight at some point when they eventually leave. Yes, he says, we've been here nearly 4 hours, which means, because detention started at 8, that they are there like past midnight doing this.
I know.
Like, oh my gosh, it is so long. Like,
it's like such a remarkably thorough kind of punishment. Like in high school for us, like if you got like in trouble, you had a 1 hour detention where you just sat quietly and did nothing.
Yeah.
Like after school or before school.
Right. Like that was it. And if it was just 4 hours of sitting there, that would be terrible. But like at the same time, like Gilderoy Lockhart has then been writing letters to fans for 4 hours.
I mean,
you know, like he's at least dedicated to his people.
It's at least it's a kind of commitment for sure, because that would be a lot of time to be sitting there just, you know, writing away.
Imagine if he had to address the envelopes too.
Goodness me.
But apparently this also just makes you think, though, like,
what,
you know,
when hours,
like. Exactly, but like, you know, when the owls are delivering the letters to Harry, the envelopes are always addressed so humorously, and it's like, it just feels like they're sort of like magically addressed.
You're right.
It's like, yeah. When do they ever have to address? Like, why do you have to address the envelope? Are you using regular mail? Or isn't this just going to be like, take this one to Gladys Gudgeon, owl? Done.
That's a good point.
You know, like, why do they have to address it at all?
I don't know. I mean, maybe this is more like one of those things, like, where because, like, Harry has, like, affinity for Hedwig, and Hedwig knows the people that Harry knows, and there's, like, direct instructions. But, like, maybe if, like, Lockhart has to go and take what I have to assume is, like, 200 pieces of fan mail up to the owlry, like, there needs to be, like, some associated direction for the owl staff.
I guess so. Maybe that's the case. Yeah, like, if he's just going to drop them at the post office and be like, send all these.
Exactly.
Or sort of something. But, like, even that. Then it just seems like you could just like write Gladys Gudgeon on it and they'd be like, here, take this to Gladys.
Yeah, exactly.
You
know,
like,
yeah.
By addressing the envelopes, you mean like just writing their name on it? Or
Right. Maybe Harry doesn't have that hard of a task.
Yeah, it's not that bad. Because otherwise, how does Lockhart know all their addresses?
You know? Also impressive. Like, maybe there's like a return mail thing on all the fan mail itself so that they can do that. Either which way, though, there's a couple of other like deeply important things that happen here, which is that for the first time we get the
basilisk.
Yes, the ice cold venom voice that says, come to me, let me rip you, let me tear you, let me kill you, which this has never really stood out to me before, but it's sort of like violent for a snake that like is primarily like its primary dangerous characteristic is its eyes.
Yeah.
You know? So, like, I mean, I guess it also has basilisk venom, which, it, as far as we know, is one of the most powerfully toxic materials in all of the wizarding world.
But, yeah.
It doesn't seem like the tearing and the ripping and such. It's just a little dramatic.
I know. It's like, I love it. This is just sort of the snake's inner monologue. He's just like slithering around, just like, I'm gonna kill.
I know.
I'm gonna kill you. I'm gonna rip you up.
I know. If this basilisk hung out with other basilisks, they were like, "Did you do the thing again?" He'd be like, "What? What thing?" It's like, "Did you patrol saying all the things that you're gonna do?"
Yeah. Also, this isn't in the basilisk's mind. Sorry, I said inner monologue. He's talking. The basilisk is talking to itself out loud to nobody.
Yes. Right? Yes. And presumably, like, that's the other thing too, is that like nobody can understand snakes, but people should still hear a noise.
You'd think.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, but either which way, it's fine. But yeah, so I do remember as a kid reading this particular page for the first time and it terrifying me.
Oh, really?
Like, yeah, this was definitely like very scary. Like, oh man, like, you know, like what is it? What could it be? So yeah, I remember that as a kid. It's definitely like a good way to like take the tone of the story that's been sort of just like, you know, it's had like some like bummer type of moments so far, but like nothing like dark. And now we're definitely like, you know, it's like, okay, this is pretty intense all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. This is maybe like a little bit scary.
Yeah.
But Lockhart obviously doesn't hear the voice, and so that can be like a little bit jarring. Finally, they get back to the Gryffindor common room where Harry runs into Ron, where interestingly, there's also like another clue as to what's happening from like what Ron has been doing, because he had to polish the award for special services to the school.
Right, which ends up being a fairly important little piece of information they get there.
Since it's specifically for Tom Riddle. Finding who opened, or who believed to have opened the Chamber of Secrets, which was, of course, Hagrid.
Yeah.
So a couple, like lots of little seeds are being planted.
There really are. Chapter. There's also just like a little possible continuity error here where it says 14 times he made me buff up that Quidditch cup before he was satisfied, which is interesting, just because I think later on McGonagall says like she can't stand the sight of the Quidditch cup in Snape's office or something, or like she would like to bring it back to her office or something like that. Like, it makes it sound like there is but a singular Quidditch cup that changes location based on the last year's season champion or whatever.
Yeah.
So it's like, Shouldn't the Quidditch Cup be wherever whoever won last year is?
It does.
Why
seem,
is it in the trophy room?
I mean, yeah, and that's like an easy one to like just sort of like miss on because it's like it's the trophy room and it's a trophy. Why wouldn't it be in
right,
the trophy
room?
But it's like you're right. There does seem to be like a very like I think the Stanley Cup in hockey is that way.
Where right. Like yeah. It's like there's a single trophy.
Right. Yeah. Like it's not like the Super Bowl where there's like a trophy that goes to like each year's winning team. Like the Stanley Cup just like is the same Stanley Cup and it just goes from like team to team to team based.
Right.
On
like while you have it, you have it. But right. Then you better win again or we're going
to
take it.
We're going to take it. Yeah, it's going to go to the next place. So anyway, but that pretty much wraps off our chapter for us.
It does.
Which honestly, this was kind of funny because coming into the chapter today, I was sort of like, I don't know. I was like, was there enough to really like put together like a really like firm, because a lot of the chapter is sort of like explaining the rules of Quidditch, which of course everybody like who is listening to this podcast already knows.
Yes.
So there's like a little bit of like exposition type stuff that's going on, but then there is enough important stuff going on as well that like there you gotta go through and sort of like dial in on all those details. So that was really fun.
Yes, it was. Yeah. So yeah, we ended up having a lot more to say about it than I would have. Then, as is always the case,
but I know. Yeah.
Thought, yeah.
Now I'll be especially curious about our next chapter, which is going to be chapter 8, the Death Day Party, because this is another one of those chapters where it's like it. I would rank it up there next to the break in at the Ministry in Deathly Hallows, where they go undercover and
oh yeah,
and all that stuff. It's like it's like I love heists and I don't like that chapter and I don't know if it's like the use of the Polyjuice potion or like maybe even like the audiobook, like Jim Dale like provides all of the voices as like different characters versus right. Just like Harry, Ron, and Hermione. I don't know what's going on with it, but the Death Day Party is another one of these chapters where I'm just sort of like, that's forgettable.
Yeah, the Death Day Party. Yeah, I mean, they skip it entirely in the movie.
They do, which is ironic. I mean, I'm saying that as if it's not an important chapter because we know important things will happen inside of that chapter. So we'll just have to look forward to next week and again, chapter 8, the Death Day Party.
Yes, we will. Yes, we will. In the meantime, I've got a review here.
Oh, okay. Lay it on me.
From Shika Gomez. It says, so much fun every week. Greetings from Puerto Rico. You guys are actually the reason I got into Harry Potter in the first place, and now, thanks to the podcast, I actually look forward to driving to school. It's been a blast. Really looking forward to all of them. Question that's kind of been bothering me for a while. Why do the Deathly Hallows have such a legendary status when they're all basically duds that don't really accomplish their claim to fame? Harry gets found a bunch of times with the cloak, the Elder Wand changes masters all the time, and the stone doesn't even do the thing in its name. Just seems like people would notice they aren't as amazing as the stories portrayed them.
I think that there is absolutely a fair amount of truth to that. I mean, I think the Elder Wand by creation is kind of paradoxical, where it's like it's the most powerful wand that ever existed, but then because you become the target of other powerful wizards, it's sort of like it continues to bolster its reputation
right.
for greatness, but also continues to paint the target on the back of he who yields it or she who yields it
yeah.
in a way that is very much like it's a blessing and a curse, sort of like, you know, if you've got it, then people want it. And
right.
You know, it's that becomes like the Game of Thrones type of situation.
It really is. Yeah. And it's like, it doesn't even seem like, I think we recently made a theory that like maybe the Elder Wand has only ever had like two masters maybe.
That
Dumbledore and Harry are the only people to like ever have been like true masters of the Elder Wand, and everyone else just sort of, it's like its reputation is what's doing most of its work.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, like it is the most powerful if you are its master, but like most people just aren't, and it's just a wand, and they're just powerful because they seek power, and that's like partially because they're already powerful, and so they get the wand, and that like it looks powerful because they're powerful, but that's about it.
Yeah. So I mean, and that's the thing. Yeah. I mean, of course, it continuously performs extraordinary magic because it's always in the hands of extraordinary people. The thing that Harry does in particular, and we would suggest that Dumbledore does, is repair another wand.
Yeah.
In a way that actually successfully repairs it, which is what we know Harry does with his Holy Wand at the end of Deathly Hallows.
Right. And what we assume Dumbledore has done for Hagrid.
Yes, exactly, because Hagrid's wand is supposedly what we'll learn in this very book is eventually snapped in half, or maybe even is described in the first book. I think it is. Maybe they said it's snapped in half. But
yeah, because Ollivander talks to him about it. He's like, but you don't use it.
Right. Yeah, and so it's funny because there's like always this sort of like quiet little illusion that like Hagrid's wand is like inside of like the flowery pink umbrella, and it's just like it just is in the pink umbrella. Like, I don't know who we're kidding here. It's like, it's absolutely
it's definitely
in there.
And it's like, look how Ron's wand is behaving. And it's not even like fully broken in half. Like, apparently Hagrid's is fully broken in half and he never has any problems with it, whilst it is also concealed as an umbrella. And it's like, it's because it's not broken at all. Like, it's concealed because it's not broken.
Yes. So what we always wanted to see out of the Fantastic Beasts series was a scenario where, obviously, with Beast being at the central focus of the larger narrative of Dumbledore versus Grindelwald, we always just assumed that Hagrid was going to eventually be involved in such a way, because Hagrid would be expelled in 1942, and that would be 3 years prior to the duel with Grindelwald.
Right.
And so what we've always assumed is that, like, the reason that Albus Dumbledore trusts Hagrid with his life is because in that interim, Hagrid does something to earn that trust, and the reward that Dumbledore then can bestow onto Hagrid as, like, his show of gratitude, being the new wielder of the Elder Wand, is to repair Hagrid's own wand and then permit him, you know, like, intermittent usage as needed, which obviously is still sort of kept largely under wraps. So that's sort of the sentiment there, is that the Elder Wand does have special powers, but they need to be earned by the Elder Wand's respect.
Yeah. But otherwise, it's like, as far as your question, why do the Deathly Hallows have such a legendary status? It's like the Invisibility Cloak and the Resurrection Stone really don't have legendary status. Like, most people don't know of their existence at all, or else just sort of consider them fairy tale objects. Like, they really aren't legendary objects. And I mean, like, Harry does effectively use the Resurrection Stone. It's like it doesn't bring people back from the dead, but, like, it can do a thing.
It can do something.
Yeah.
And like, that is
unique.
Right. Yes. Like, you could call on your lost loved ones. I suppose, depending on whether or not you subscribe to the belief that death created it versus the three brothers, just being clever wizards, which we sort of toggle back and forth on, sort of just depending on the narrative. But, like, the Resurrection Stone and the Elder Wand were both supposed to be lures for death, and largely they are.
Yeah, and that's, like, you know, that's also the Harry difference, where it's like, oh, it's a big trick by death, where it's like, it's supposed to drive you mad because you can't be with the person you love.
Right.
Because they're dead, but, like, you know, so that'll make you want to be dead. But then Harry is, of course, completely different, and he's able to use it in the successful way to bring people to help, like, literally escort him to death on purpose.
Right, which follows the theme that, like, death is not something that should be necessarily feared, in some capacity. Whereas then the Invisibility Cloak, of course, has, like, the special function of being passed from hand to hand, and is largely considered to be the more wise choice of the three Hallows. Mm-hmm. And our latest insertion is that in King's Cross, when Harry is talking to him after he's, like, in limbo, Dumbledore alludes by saying, like, the cloak never worked for me as it would for its true master. And that sort of suggests, like, that the cloak does do something extraordinary for whoever it actually, like, belongs to.
Right, because the other qualities of the cloak are that it never fades, it continues to endure over time, and that it can, like... And, like, Dumbledore says, like, it can shield others as well as itself. And it's like... But even in the book, even this far, like, when Ron is feeding Norbert the rats, like, he just takes the Invisibility Cloak off by himself, like, down by himself, and uses it, and it's like, it still makes Ron invisible, even though he's not, like, the true master of it. So it's like, it does what it says on the box all of the time, no matter who's wearing it. So it just sounds like Dumbledore is suggesting there is an extra power associated with the cloak for its true master, which Harry would be. And so, yeah, our latest theory, which we've been working on this one for, like, 5 weeks now on the What If James Had Kept the Invisibility Cloak series over on the main channel.
Yes.
Is that for the true master, the cloak would make you not just invisible, but unfindable, like, in a similar capacity to, like, the Fidelius charm or something.
Yeah, exactly. So, yep. And I think, like, there's the one instance, I think, where Draco spots Harry jumping on, like, the luggage rack in Half-Blood Prince and is able to, like, you know, Harry's under the cloak, but Malfoy knows he's up there. And
he, like, sees his ankle.
He sees his ankle. So that's the thing. It's like Malfoy could just be directing a spell at where he believes Harry to be, which also happens to be where he is. So that's that would probably be, like, the biggest, like point of contention for this particular belief, because while Harry is otherwise very frequently nearly caught under the invisibility cloak, I can't think of any instances where somebody like finds him and like yanks it off of him.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like, haha, we found you.
Yeah. I think the out for the Malfoy situation is that he sees his ankle up there.
Yeah, that would be so my argument as well.
There is. And I think Moody can see through it as well.
That's
a whole different can of worms. And I think it speaks more to the power of the eye than it does to the failings of the cloak.
Yeah, which if you wanted to like delve into that theory, the very broad strokes version of it is that like Grindelwald also has a blue eye. And so like we've sometimes suggested, like, is there a chance that, like, because we know that Dumbledore and Moody have been like longtime allies and you know, have like worked together against Dark Wizard. So it's like, that's another situation where it's like, in a Fantastic Beasts perfect case scenario, is a world where we see like a really young up and coming Alistair Moody, who like plays a vital role in like what he takes from the situation is the swiveling blue eye, and like and you discover that like what Grindelwald in his hunt for things of caliber such as the Deathly Hallows, there are in fact other magical artifacts out there of similar caliber, one of which could be like an all-seeing eye.
Right, yeah. I mean, and then like an all-seeing eye is just like an also sort of like a recurring trope in like fantasy and stuff, like via like Odin or
Sauron
or those sort of things.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It does seem like we don't know the full history of the eye. Like, was it given to him? I was wondering this the other day, did Moody lose an eye and then was given it as a replacement, or did he just like replace it himself because he found this one?
That's a good question as well. It seems like based on his gnarled state, he largely, I would assume that he would have lost.
That's what I assume. Yeah.
And that would be because even like there's something so weird to me about eyes, and like I feel like I could get like real weird about it, but like, it's like, I can't imagine optionally being like, I'm going to upgrade my eye.
Okay, well, you know what? Just to continue this theme is that even in Name of the Wind, the other series we love is that Celatos just does this exact thing.
You're right. Yeah,
he just stabs his own eye out and gets a greater vision or whatever. Yes, I don't know.
Man who cut out his own eye and saw better. There's a really
good line. About it in the book, but you know,
either way,
that's for a different podcast.
That's exactly. There you go.
You think we have a lot to say about Harry Potter? My goodness.
Gosh, Name of the Wind. Yeah, if you haven't checked it out, please do. Otherwise, I think that should be everything for today.
That should be everything for today. Join us next time as we venture into Chapter 8, The Death Day Party, on Through the Gryffindor.
Today's episode was edited by Ethan Edgehill. Vaishon Brandon does our art. Catherine Stein is our production manager, and the show is hosted by me and Jonathan Carlin.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy 5 or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.